Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the GAS programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by James Henderson, who's director of the OIES, to discuss the key messages that came from the second of two workshops that the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies held on the 22nd of January 2021 in cooperation with the Energy Futures Initiative, EFI, and the Centre for the Study of Democracy, CSD, in Bulgaria. And this workshop was on the future of gas in Europe and implication for global geopolitics. Now, this second workshop actually focuses on the challenges for the gas in a net zero economy, focusing on the period 2030 to 2050, when the first of our podcasts actually focused on the period before that. Jim, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, David. Good to be here again, and looking forward to the discussion.
Jim, why don't we start this podcast that we are date stamping on the 1st of April 2021 when we're recording it by setting the scene. What could a European net zero economy look like in 2050?
Well, obviously the goal, David, is a net zero carbon emissions by then. And that has some pretty big implications across all the sectors. I mean, in the power sector, as far as coal's concerned, we're talking really getting rid of all unabated coal by 2030. And we're talking about emissions intensity in the sector falling from 60 grams a kilowatt hour to maybe 10 grams a kilowatt hour by 2045. And actually, that means by 2050, not much scope for gas-fired power in the sector either, really offshore wind becoming the main source of power by then. If you look at the other sectors, then electrification is a key theme. You know, we're talking about 45% of all final consumption coming from electricity. And we're talking about, you know, the share of EVs for new car sales rising to pretty much 100%. We're talking about much greater efficiency across many sectors, including residential. From a gas perspective, we're seeing the need for abated gas really across the economy. So low carbon gases, hydrogen at the forefront, biogas, biomethane also playing a role. In terms of emissions, we've got the transport sector really being the biggest emitter by then, and the power sector emissions, net emissions at least, being pretty much close to zero. So the story really is one of unabated hydrocarbons really having to be removed from the energy economy, and only decarbonized fuels really having much of a role.
So am I right in thinking that zero emissions may not be achievable in all sectors then?
It doesn't look like it. I mean, in terms of net zero emissions, that may well be possible, but it looks like in the transport sector, we might be struggling. I think in the power sector, it's more likely. And I think there are some sectors where, we're going to have to really work hard to find fuels that can meet some of the demand, because electrification is not going to answer all the questions, particularly for heat, particularly in industrial heat at high temperatures. So I think we are going to have to be searching for other forms of decarbonized fuel, which is where the kind of gaseous fuel solution comes in.
Yeah, I was just wondering as we're talking, whether it is possible that low carbon gases could play a greater role in some sectors. Did you discuss that at the workshop?
Yeah, certainly we did. I think there's for sure a role in the power sector for storage, particularly, hydro. We're talking the sort of power to gas story, where hydrogen essentially becomes the sort of flexibility in the system as renewables play a much, much bigger role. And then we're talking in the industrial sectors where high temperatures are required. At the moment, at least, it's very difficult for electrification to reach those high temperatures. So using some forms of gaseous fuels, particularly hydrogen, can be and probably will be part of the solution. And then in residential, again, electrification certainly is part of the answer. But given the infrastructure in place and given the current use of gaseous fuels, decarbonized fuels certainly can be, again, part of the answer. So I think that, there's for sure a role. I think it's, as described by one of the discussants, the role is more likely to be less as a sort of base load and more as backup, and therefore prices are likely to be more volatile. So the kind of generating value from the gaseous fuels is going to be a very different proposition, but they will still have a role in the energy economy,
Okay, well, let's focus on the gas value chain for a minute. With the immediate challenge to reduce emissions intensity of the gas value chain, Did you at the workshop discuss how this could be achieved and perhaps, you know, whether new technology will be required to achieve this?
Well, I think in terms of the gas value chain, the real discussion was around emissions. I mean, you know, the big problem with gas establishing its credentials in the future a net zero energy economy is if we're still producing, transporting methane, even if we're turning it into hydrogen at the end of the day, there is this big issue with emissions in the value chain. And so we're really talking about, you know, how to monitor that, how to reduce it, and how to verify. So we did discuss all those issues. They're obviously a topic of very current discussion with the European Methane Emissions Strategy. They're also, of course, a current topic because of the measurements and all the kind of calibration that's being required for some LNG deliveries now. And obviously a big discussion around US LNG and the emissions from US shale, which could undermine the carbon credentials, if you like, of US LNG. So we discussed all those issues in the context of Europe in particular, which appears to be setting the standards, if you like, for the delivery of reduced carbon energy into its system.
But what about a kind of combination of biomethane and hydrogen? You know, could that have a future in Europe, do you think?
Well, I think that there's really two distinct discussions based around the starting points, if you like, for many countries in the region. I think one of the things that was acknowledged was that countries are operating from very different starting points and very different attitudes towards hydrogen and biomethane. So biomethane tends to be a rather localized product, relatively small scale. The potential is there, really. I mean, the discussion was around sort of 10 to 15% of current gas demand ultimately being taken up by biogas or biomethane. Now, if it can be injected into the grid and there is, you know, regulations are being mooted to allow that, then there could be a broader use of biogas, biomethane. But at the moment, it looks like quite a local product. With hydrogen, the question, I'm sure we'll come on to this, is how it's generated, whether there is a CO2 that needs to be stored as a result of its creation. If there is CO2 that needs to be stored because it's been steam reformed methane, then that limits the countries in which it becomes of interest, because many countries don't have access to kind of reservoirs and places to store CO2. If it's green hydrogen generated from renewable electricity and water, then there's a broader usage. Now, but I think that the concept really for hydrogen was that we would see local clusters initially, probably mostly in Northwest Europe, and then they would gradually spread out as, if you like, the industrial clusters acted as a base load, if you like, which could, and then infrastructure could gradually spread out through other industries, even into residential and commercial ultimately. And I think there is a concept of a hydrogen backbone, either within countries or indeed across the whole of Europe. But I think that's very much a longer-term development after initially seeing local areas, then regions and countries develop their hydrogen kind of portfolios, if you like.
Well, why don't we build on the discussion on hydrogen? Because at the workshop, you looked at the challenges facing the development of a hydrogen network, and actually you used the UK as an example. So I wondered, could you share with our listeners some of the conclusions of that discussion?
Certainly. So, I mean, we had a very interesting speaker from National Grid who came to talk about the kind of the potential for the growth of hydrogen in the UK. Initially, the growth is very much seen as coming from blue hydrogen. So, you know, bringing methane onshore, steam reforming or auto reforming, and then taking the CO2 and storing it, and using the hydrogen, as I've mentioned, in these local clusters in the northeast or northwest of the country, supplying really as a test local industry, potential backup for power stations, and also some small residential areas. And then the question from there is, one, how do you increase the supply of hydrogen? Do you continue with blue, or do you start to develop, as they are, for example, in Scotland with Scottish Power, green hydrogen, mainly via wind power and electrolysis. And that's one end of the, so at the supply end, what type of hydrogen was one producing? And then at the demand end, you know, can consumers be convinced that they want to make the shift to a new fuel? Can they be incentivized to do that? Because it's probably going to be initially at least somewhat more expensive. And then in the middle, of course, what National Grid are trying to work out is, you know, where's the supply going to be generated? Where's the demand going to come from? And how do they put the two together? And how do they ensure the resilience of the current system, supplying methane, of course, with the development of a new system without essentially double counting pipelines? And, you know, is there a way of managing the transition period in an efficient way to avoid excessive investment and stranded assets? So those are really the challenges that are being faced at the moment. And we're very much at the test stage. There was a lot of discussion around testing pipes to see what levels of hydrogen could be passed through them, from the current 0.1% up to 10%, then 20%, and ultimately 100%. And to see how the various seals, the pipes themselves, the compressor stations would operate under different levels of hydrogen. So very much at the test stage at the moment, but with a longer term plan to potentially bring it all together, you know, as we get into the late 2030s, early 2040s.
It is all a matter of systems resilience, isn't it, really? And maintaining the existing energy sources while the move to hydrogen is happening. And of course, you know, the whole, if gas demand is forecast to fall by 80% by 2050, you know, we ask what is going to happen to the existing gas infrastructure. But my question to you, Jim, is on a matter of policy, you know. What policy is required? You know, how can one drive the required investment and consumer behaviour that we've been talking about?
Well, that's a very good question. And there was a lot of debate about the regulation and the adaptation of current gas market regulation, questions about whether a liberalised market is really one that can allow for the development of new technologies and can allow for the investments in new infrastructure where the returns are very much more uncertain. There was talk about using things like contracts for difference to try and, you know, catalyze some form of competition. But some of the more radical interventions were really saying that although governments and the EU in particular don't like to pick winners, the timescales we're talking about really may not allow for, you know, permitting the market to work out what the best solutions are, because it may be that the only way of achieving these targets, particularly by 2030, but even by 2050, is to really go through a process of learning by doing. So, you know, the governments will effectively have to say, we're going to do this, and then we go and do this in the best way we can. And we've sort of seen that with solar and wind, with the subsidies that were provided. And there was a lot of, you know, argument that essentially, the EU appears to have picked hydrogen as the winner and essentially picked green hydrogen as the winner. And so therefore, you know, it might be better if we just said, right, well, that's what we're going to do. Let's everyone go away and do that as best we can. And if we need to do blue hydrogen in the meantime, fine, that's one step along the way. But we all know what the ultimate goal is. So I think there is still a debate, because obviously that outcome is completely contradictory to the liberalized gas market that we currently operate in, where competition is everything and where the value chain has been split up specifically to avoid any sorts of monopolies emerging. And you know, therefore, picking winners, allowing monopolies to operate to get things going is completely opposite to that. But it may be what required. That's certainly what was being argued at the meeting. That may have to be the solution, given the timescales involved.
Well, can we perhaps, you know, move the conversation for a few minutes to the geopolitical implications for the future of gas during the period 2030 to 2050. Now, in our first podcast, that I hope all our listeners have managed to listen to, we focused on the next 10 years. And I just wonder, you know, is there still going to be an issue of security of energy supply to Europe in 2030 plus?
Well, I think the answer to that question is really going to come down to how fast the process of decarbonisation occurs. If we do move ahead, then it certainly would seem that some of the security of supply issues that we have now, particularly around Russia, Ukraine, Nord Stream 2, will become a lot less relevant because, as you said, natural gas demand will go into decline. However, you know, it then raises a different set of questions. If we go to a hydrogen economy and we start to import hydrogen, then all those questions could raise their heads again, but for different countries. You know, North Africa, Ukraine could reappear, the Middle East could appear as hydrogen exporters to Europe. Indeed, Russia, in some sense, could still be involved if we're importing its methane to turn into blue hydrogen, or indeed if Russia starts exporting hydrogen full stop. There's then the question of technology. If Europe moves away from hydrocarbons and into renewables, then, you know, for example, if it tries to become a technological leader in batteries, for example, then we may see security of supply concerns over the import of the vital minerals and metals that are required. If it doesn't become a technology provider, then it may have to rely more on low-cost producers like China, which again raises different geopolitical issues. I think the other final point to make on geopolitics is, you know, we've already seen within Europe that different countries have different standpoints on the transition. They're coming from different starting points, different levels of GDP per capita, et cetera. We could see that, you know, spread out across the globe, and different views on the pace of transition, the ultimate goals of transition, you know, could in themselves create some geopolitical tensions. And indeed, you know, we've already seen that in the debate and in the Trump era, at least with the United States. So I think that there'll be different geopolitical issues, potentially leaving our current worries behind, but creating different levels of concern, if you like.
So am I reading into this, Jim, that at the workshop, you know, you felt there was going to be kind of pluralism emerge between countries and regions taking different paths towards disparate goals rather than having a consensus? Or did the workshop attendees think that there would be a more consensual approach?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I mean, I think globally it's very, very clear that the future of hydrocarbons is going to be rather different in Asia than it is in Europe. In Asia, gas is currently part of the solution, thanks to significant amounts of coal switching potential, whereas in Europe, gas is really becoming part of the problem now because a lot of the coal switching has already happened. So I think that, you know, there's a clear difference there. But even within Europe, you know, we had discussions about Southeast Europe, about Central and Eastern Europe, and about Northwest Europe. And it's clear that all those regions have very different views. I mean, a country like Poland, for example, is coming from a place where it uses a huge amount of coal and where the coal industry is very important to the economy. And so therefore, of course, the Poles have a different perspective on what the impact of the transition will be economically for them. And in Southeast Europe, again, we're looking at a different perspective, gas displacing lignite, for example, as a hugely positive thing. And so, again, gas there is really part of the solution, whereas in Northwest Europe, as I said, you know, unabated gas is really being seen as part of the problem. So even within Europe, we have a kind of a variety of views, if you like, a pluralism of views. And then that is obviously spread out across Asia, the Middle East, where, of course, you know, oil and gas are vital parts of the economy. We've got South America, where, you know, hydro and renewables are already a very large part of the energy economy in any case. And then the States, of course, where market forces are really driving everything, and we're seeing a whole new kind of attitude towards decarbonisation as we get a new administration as well. So, yeah, I don't think anyone was naive enough to think that we had a kind of global consensus yet. And certainly the risk would appear to be that we do head off in different directions without really any central coordination.
Now, there is, of course, the million-dollar question, isn't there, Jim? And that is, who's going to pay, you know? So I just wondered what the workshop saw as the role of the customer in ultimately actually paying for the decarbonisation and, you know, perhaps what sector, because the residential sector, you know, maybe is not going to be able to pay for it. Did you kind of have any conclusions in your discussions on that?
Yes, we did indeed. And I think, conclusions is difficult. We did discuss the customers a lot, and indeed that they were raised as a very, very important, having a very important role to play. I mean, some participants did suggest that customers were prepared to pay more for greener products. And the petrol forecourt was given as one example of this, where customers are prepared to pay more for greener fuels. But it was also acknowledged that the residential sector is very hard to change, that retrofitting houses, you know, making them more efficient users of energy, is going to be very difficult given the sort of the extent of the housing stock. New houses are obviously being built to certain specifications, but many old houses are very difficult to change. And so clearly residential was seen as an issue. And of course, there was there's the global justice issue, the one you've raised. I mean, who should be paying for all this? And I think that the answer to that question was that clearly incentives are going to have to be provided. Clearly, customer preferences are going to have to be taken into consideration. And indeed, the residential sector may well be one that takes much longer to decarbonize than other sectors. And so, the question really is, can you create a positive and a virtual circle, if you like, a circular carbon economy that brings in the residential sector and at what pace? And I think that generally that was seen as a challenge, which is, we felt that we've dealt with power now. If you like, there's a very clear pathway for power now. Industrial heat appears to be one where we can see certain methodologies for various sectors and various incentives to produce greener goods because they sell. But in residential, I think that's probably a third stage of the process because it is so much more difficult and because the customer base is so disparate.
Can we talk more about this global justice issue? Because I found it absolutely fascinating, Jim. I don't know whether you did discuss this at the workshop. If an economy has managed to secure lower emissions by just outsourcing it to others, can it really be considered to be successful in energy transition terms?
Well, no, absolutely not. And I think that is really one of the drivers behind the European initiative on carbon border adjustment mechanisms. I mean, is this attempt to avoid carbon leakage? So, we look fantastic because we're no longer manufacturing high carbon emitting products, but we're just importing them now from, the global south. I mean, other countries have taken on our carbon burden. So, no, absolutely not. And I think that there was a discussion around that and the need for a more global approach. And, quite rightly, representatives from outside Europe were questioning that need to pay and how one shares the technology that will be required to decarbonize across the globe. And indeed, comparisons were sort of made with the spread of or the sharing of vaccines, for the global pandemic. I mean, it is that kind of analogy. You really haven't solved the problem by getting rid of COVID-19 in your country, because if it's still prevalent in vast swathes of the world, then it's only a matter of time before the problem comes back to bite you. That's clearly also the case with the environment. There's absolutely no point in Europe being a net zero region if coal-fired power stations are pumping out carbon in other parts of the world and we're just buying their goods. So no, it was discussed, and the need to use carbon adjustment mechanisms, carbon taxes, and to ensure that consumers really, again, are at the heart of this process of choosing, really needing to choose to pay in some form or other for lower carbon products is absolutely at the heart of this issue.
Now, you talking about these issues, there's also, of course, geostrategic implications of this. And I thought it interesting in the discussions, if a country such as China is quicker in developing an industrial strategy around decarbonisation and therefore sets the standards, that could have actually implications on other regions such as Europe. And also, if your country is having a slower pace of energy transition, could it get left behind economically as well as technologically? I just wondered about those the geostrategic implications. How much of that did you discuss at the workshop?
Well, yeah, I think we'd certainly discussed the desire to become technical leader, the potential for renewable energy and the energy transition to be an industrial, not potential. The fact that it is an industrial process, it's an industrial strategy, if you like, with lots of spin-offs. I mean, we even touched on, for example, the potential for regions with significant renewable energy potential to turn into industrial heartlands, because if you're generating a significant amount of solar power, let's say in North Africa, why would you export that electricity? Why would you not develop industrial if you like, plots, petrochemical plants, steel manufacturing around the renewable energy centers. So I think the potential for countries with renewable energy resources to use them to develop an industrial base, as well as to develop new forms of or improved forms of renewable energy by being more technologically advanced, was certainly discussed. And you're absolutely right. China would be an obvious example of a country where they would appear to have the motivation and the ability and the finance to drive this forward. But yes, if you're in areas where you don't have that ability to invest and or the political will or governance structure to allow companies to feel they want to invest securely, then indeed you could get left behind. And that could create different forms of geostrategic imbalance. We've had obviously the Middle East and oil exports for the last 50 to 70 years. It's very easy to create pictures where you get a completely different balance around the technology to do with renewable energy and the industrial bases that are built up around it's both the development of those technologies, but also electricity using industrial areas around that. So yeah, absolutely.
Earlier in the podcast, you talked about green and blue hydrogen. So I was just wondering, for our listeners, could you perhaps explain the difference? And as it might take some time before we get into a green hydrogen era, is there an interplay between the two hydrogen sources? And I think linked to that, of course, is, what is the role of CCS?
So, yes, the answer, blue hydrogen essentially is methane that has been reformed, either auto-reformed or steam-reformed, into hydrogen and CO2. So there is a carbon capture and storage sort of technology that's required, and obviously a place to save the CO2. Green or renewable hydrogen is hydrogen where electricity is used to electrolyze water and split hydrogen and oxygen into split water into hydrogen and oxygen, I should say. And there the question is, what type of electricity are you using? Obviously, for it to be green hydrogen, one needs to be using renewable electricity. Really, one needs to be using surplus renewable electricity, because renewable electricity per se is better put into the grid because there are efficiency losses as one creates the hydrogen. So ideally, you want either dedicated renewable energy supply for the electrolyzer or spare renewable electricity. And of course, the hydrogen that comes out of either steam reforming or electrolysis is exactly the same. It's just an H2 molecule. So, it doesn't matter what goes into the system. But the debate is really around, over time, one would hope that you would have more and more green or renewable hydrogen as completely carbon-free. But in the meantime, the cost of blue hydrogen is much lower, about three times lower. And also the availability of methane and the technology of steam reforming and then carbon storage is much more readily available at economic cost. So it would seem that in the short to medium term, if we're going to get a hydrogen economy going, one would need to start with blue hydrogen, but develop the ability to produce green hydrogen as rapidly as possible, both by reducing the cost of electrolyzers, but also by increasing the availability of renewable electricity as the power source.
Yeah, and of course, technology advancement is going to be part of that, isn't it? Now, a question I've always wanted to ask, if I may, is rather than producing the hydrogen in gas supply countries and transporting it, say, to a market such as Europe, would it be more economic to kind of move the hydrocarbon to the market and then take away the CO2 as the hydrogen is created nearer to the end user? Did you discuss that kind of market structure or the value chain structure in the workshop?
Yeah, we did. I mean, the fundamental flaw with the continuing to move methane to the market and then creating the hydrogen in the market is that value chain issue we discussed earlier with methane leakage. I mean, the concern that people have is that if we just continue with the existing system, then we continue with the leakages. And we also have the problem of where to store the CO2. So, there's a logic behind continuing to use the existing infrastructure and creating the hydrogen in the market. And that's certainly what Gazprom, for example, would be encouraging with its use of pyrolysis. And indeed, the Norwegians have that theory, bring the the methane to the beachhead in Germany. You know, do your steam reforming, take the CO2 back and stick it in the North Sea field and take your hydrogen on into Europe. However, you know, others are advocating the potential creation of hydrogen in areas where, as I've explained, renewable energy is available. So the Middle East would be an obvious place, both for actually blue hydrogen because of the amount of gas, methane, natural gas they've got, but also potentially green hydrogen as well because of their renewables potential. And North Africa is the other one. So we had a speaker from Italy, for example, who mentioned that hydrogen was 40% cheaper to make in North Africa than it was in Italy. So why would you not import it using the existing infrastructure? Questions around how to transport hydrogen are, paramount. There's, it is a third of the heat content of methane. So transporting it is expensive. It can be transported as ammonia, and indeed there have been test shipments of ammonia from Saudi Arabia to Japan, for example. So that's a technology that's being explored. So I think that it's still very much an open question about whether you continue to exploit the existing infrastructure to move methane to the market and then turn it into hydrogen, or whether you create the hydrogen, if you like, at home and then export it. At the moment, you would say the preference is probably, certainly in the short to medium term, to the former. So bring the methane through the system and then, you know, use your steam reforming or your auto reforming or your pyrolysis and then take the CO2 away. But I think over the longer term, as technological advances proceed, as costs come down, as new infrastructure is built, we may see the potential for a hydrogen trade to open up.
Well, look, Jim, we're coming to the end of our time, as we always do on these podcasts. But I always like to kind of end up with what I hope is a challenging question or a future-looking question. And the one I'd like to ask you today is, you know, what is the real cost of the energy transition? And, you know, will governments effectively have to pay subsidies to support its development? You know, is that something that you really addressed at the workshop?
Well, it is. And I think there's, you know, the governments are already paying subsidies and have been for the development of renewable energy. And I think the argument around hydrogen in particular is that it seems very unlikely that, incentives can be provided either to companies themselves and also to the people who are going to finance those companies to really make things happen on a fast enough trajectory, unless, you know, specific incentives are provided by government. So whether they be subsidies, whether they be a more aggressive carbon price, or whether they be just mandated investments and fixed prices. I mean, the field of options is wide open. And I think some fairly radical solutions were discussed at the workshop. As I mentioned at the beginning, you know, some people arguing that given the timescales, governments really have to intervene very aggressively, because allowing markets to work just is not gonna have the effect on the timescales that we've set ourselves. So I think, yes, there is undoubtedly going to be a cost. One would hope that in learning by doing, we would bring those costs down fairly rapidly. Historical precedents being, in solar and wind, providing some hope that in hydrogen we can also bring costs down. But at the end of the day, the ultimate cost is some form of environmental disaster occurring in the next 20 to 30 years with, an unknowable impact on the global economy. And so I guess one has to weigh up the short-term cost of new energy sources that are a bit more expensive than our current energy sources with the potential and increasingly likely long-term cost of the environmental impact on the global economy of whatever it is, rising sea waters, more violent weather systems, et cetera, et cetera. So I think one way or another, there's a cost to be borne. And I think as far as the workshop was concerned, the feeling was that governments really need to step in sooner rather than later and provide the incentives for change, the financial incentives for change. Otherwise, we're going to move too slowly.
Yeah, and I wonder whether the impact of the global pandemic that we've seen during 2020 and indeed 2021 is maybe going to make people realise these events can or will happen and maybe focus their mind. Well, look, Jim, thank you so much for your time. You know, as always, you know, I've really enjoyed our conversation, which today was on the key messages that came from the second of the two OIES, EFI, CSD workshops on the challenges for gas in a net zero economy. And in this podcast, we focused on the period 2030 to 2050. Now, if you haven't heard it already, please listen to the first podcast that covers the role of natural gas in the energy transition with the focus on the next 10 years, 2020 to 2030. Well, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.